From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The teenagers Mary Previty works with are drug dealers, killers, muggers, arsonists, and prostitutes. She tries to create an atmosphere that is safe, structured, and hopeful. Ironically, that place is a detention center. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Previty about running the Camden Youth Center in New Jersey, where teenagers accused of crimes are locked up until family court decides what to do with them. We'll also hear from two of the teenagers who have stayed at the center, one after dealing drugs, the other after committing a crime of violence. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Authorities say the shooting rampage on a commuter train on Long Island apparently was inspired by racial hatred. Officials say the black suspect carried notes expressing hatred for whites, Asians, and wealthy blacks. Colin Ferguson of Brooklyn has been arraigned on 4 counts of murder and has been ordered held without bail. He is accused of boarding the crowded train, waiting until it crossed from New York City onto Long Island, and opening fire with a semi-automatic pistol. The Nassau County Police Commissioner says the gunman waited until the train left New York because of his respect for Mayor David Dinkins. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is urging Israel and the PLO to begin implementing their peace accord as soon as possible, but he says a short delay in beginning the withdrawal of Israeli troops will not hurt the agreement. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Secretary Christopher says it won't be a major setback if the December 13th deadline for an agreement on Israel's withdrawal from Gaza and Jericho is delayed a few days. But at a joint press conference with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, he said implementing the Israeli PLO peace accord is the best way to reassure Israelis and Palestinians living in the occupied territories.
The sooner that they can begin the actual implementation, the more progress they'll be made. And the less the likelihood is of violence.
Palestinians say not meeting the deadline would hurt the credibility of the accord, but Israel suggested the deadline's not realistic. Christopher travels to Damascus tomorrow, where he's expected to announce resumption of Israeli-Syrian negotiations. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
The political situation is still unsettled in the Ivory Coast following the death yesterday of the West African nation's longtime president. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
In the Ivory Coast, flags flew at half-mast as the country began observing a month of official mourning in honor of President Félix Houphouët-Boigny. Houphouët-Boigny died yesterday at his home village of Yamoussoukro after a long bout with cancer. The Ivorian leader, believed to be much older than 88 years old, led his country to independence from France in 1960. He was Africa's longest-serving head of state, and tributes to the fallen leader poured in from around the world. Meanwhile, Parliamentary Speaker Henri Konan-Bédié has proclaimed himself Houphouët-Boigny's successor. Under the country's revised constitution, Konan-Bédié will serve out the last 2 years of Houphouët-Boigny's term. But Prime Minister Alassane Ouattara and opposition leaders say they will challenge the constitutional provision and try to force a new round of presidential elections. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The Federal Reserve reports today that consumers spent more money in November, suggesting that the economy continues to expand at a moderate pace. The Fed's so-called Beige Book report is more upbeat than the last one a month ago. The report says manufacturing activity is growing across the country, but few businesses are hiring. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 13 points in heavy trading. This is NPR. Boeing is advising airlines to check bolts on the engine struts of 700 Boeing 747s and 767s. The company says the bolts were never fastened to specifications, but both Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration say the planes are safe to fly. A spokesman for the company says there are about 100 bolts per strut, and they were fastened to varying degrees of tightness rather than to a uniform standard. Britain's former prime minister has denied that her administration ignored its own rules over arms sales to Iraq. Margaret Thatcher's testimony came today in a special inquiry that started more than a year ago. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from London.
Former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher defended government decisions that led to arms sales to Baghdad, but she said she knew nothing about those decisions. Her testimony today is in contrast with other government ministers who have already spoken before the judge. One senior official said that Thatcher was given confidential reports on the arms sales. Another said she had explicitly approved arms export licenses to Baghdad. After more than a year's investigation, it's now known that Britain helped Iraq rebuild its arms industry after Baghdad's long war with Iran, a policy that lasted until 1990, almost to the day that Iraq invaded neighboring Kuwait. Intelligence information that has seeped out of the inquiry indicates that equipment sold to Iraq by British manufacturers may have been used in Iraq's nuclear program. In London, this is Deborah Amos.
The scientists who use the Hubble Space Telescope say they won't know for weeks whether the repairs done by the shuttle astronauts have fixed the telescope. The astronauts have replaced equipment to compensate for a flawed main mirror. During the latest spacewalk, they installed new small mirrors and a computer with greater memory. Tonight, the crew will boost Hubble's orbit by a few miles. It'll put it on a safer level above the Earth. I'm Barbara Campbell. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Poor young people today are growing up in an atmosphere that those of us who are older or better off have difficulty comprehending. Children are dealing drugs and carrying guns, sometimes with no one in the family to tell them to stop. We're going to meet two young people who were arrested for crimes and are now trying to straighten themselves out. Each spent time at the Camden County Youth Center, a detention center in New Jersey. Later, we'll meet the administrator, Mary Previty, whose mission is to help young people. Our first guest was taken to the center after he was charged with aggravated assault. He's 15 years old, of Italian descent, and lives with his parents, a 6-year-old sister, 13-year-old cousin, and both grandmothers. Because he's underage, he will remain anonymous. He's now at a residential education program administered by the Camden County Probation Office. If he doesn't make it through this program, he will be sent to training school, what used to be called reform school. He told me he started getting into trouble when he was young, doing things like lighting small fires.
We put stuff in a trash can or whatever, and then we got in trouble for doing that kind of stuff. Or, like, if there was cars in the lot, we'd, like, break the windows or something.
What's the pleasure of setting fire to something?
Well, I don't know. We just, like, did it. Like, I guess because there's nothing else to do, really.
Mm-hmm. When you got older, did most of your friends carry weapons?
A lot of them do, but, like, about 95% of them do with stuff because they, like, they think that they need it for protection or whatever.
Guns?
Guns, knives, like, not sticks, I wouldn't call it, like a pole or something.
Is it easy to get a gun?
Yeah, it is. Like, in my house now, you could go in these apartments and just get one. And you can also go to, like, Philly, Camden. Just get right off the speed line. There's certain places you can go and get a gun.
What kinds of places? Are you talking about stores or underground places?
There's people's apartments that sell them. There's, like, pizza stores. All kinds of stuff. People on the streets.
So if most of the people you know have guns or knives or sticks that they're carrying around, is it possible to go around without carrying yourself?
It is, but it isn't. Because then you always got that feeling that someone's out to get you, so you got to make sure you're ready to get them before they get you. And then sometimes it's like you don't need it because you know you're not going to get in trouble or you just don't want that kind of problem that day or whatever.
What kind of weapon would you carry?
Would I carry, or do I carry?
What did you carry?
I had a gun before that, and I had knives and stuff. But most of the time, I ain't carry nothing unless I was going somewhere like big.
Now, what's a big place where you'd have to be sure you had a weapon?
All right, it's like the mall. Sometimes it depends, it depends what you're going there for. If you're going there just to shop, if you're going to be there fast, you don't really need it, but if you're going to be there just to hang out, something could happen, so you're going to take your gun. And, like, parties and stuff, just in case something happens.
Now, one of your friends was killed with battery acid?
Yeah.
What happened?
Well, he was addicted to cocaine, right? And he was doing it for a while, and then all of a sudden, someone just gave him blow, which is cocaine, and they just, it was battery acid, and he did it, and he died.
You have a poem that was published in the newsletter, What's Happening. It's the newsletter at the Camden County Youth Center called Joey Died of Drugs. Can I ask you to read that for us?
Yeah. All right. When my friend Joey died, his mom asked me, tell me the truth. Did Joey do drugs? She was crying. I was stuttering. How do you tell your best friend's mom that her son's a geezer, died of beet drugs, blow, and battery acid? I hid my face in my hands, pulled the hat down over my face so I didn't have to look at Joey's mom. I kept thinking it was all my fault. I shouldn't have dissed him when he needed my help. Shouldn't have called him a geezer. I knew the girl did drugs. I shouldn't have hooked Joey up with her. We all went out and got drunk that night.
So did you end up saying anything to his mother?
Yeah, I told her. Like she just kept on asking. And then I was just like, and I stuttered, and I was like, yeah. And she was like, why didn't you try to help him? And I was like, I did, but he wouldn't listen. But then we just didn't try no more and everything.
So did you feel guilty because you had set him up with someone who did drugs?
Yeah, because, like, we was at a party, and I knew this girl. Well, I knew definitely that she did it, but, like, my people told me that she did blow and all. And he thought she looked good, and I was like, all right, I'll go get a number for you. And I did, and they started talking and everything. And then I found out for good that she did. And then I didn't tell him, and then all of a sudden he just started doing it with her and everything because she did it, I guess, or whatever. And then all of a sudden he was doing it with her.
What are some of your best and worst childhood memories?
My best childhood memories?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Like, doing good in school so my parents be proud of me. Just being with my family. Like, when we used to go on vacation and stuff, because we'd all be together. And that's about Christmas time, there was good memories because all my family was there, and it was, like, there was nobody missing or anything. Like, holidays, basically. Like, that's about it, really. And my worst childhood memories, that's a lot of them. Like, I put my parents down for failing in school, doing bad in school, getting in trouble, getting locked up. Well, not locked up, well, getting in trouble with the cops and stuff. Being here. And then when I was younger, just doing all stupid stuff.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been at the Camden Detention Center?
Well, the detention center, I was there for 4 months. And I've been here for 3 at the prep program.
At the prep program?
Yeah.
Did you feel you're learning interesting things there?
Yeah, I learned a lot.
What kinds of stuff?
Like, not to snap. Like, if someone says something to me, don't feed to it, too. Like, if someone's going to say something about my mom, if I know it's not true, why should I say anything back? But, and if it is true, I shouldn't say anything anyway because it's not worth it. And so just not to fight. We're not feeding into anybody's stuff because that's what gets me in trouble.
Do you wish you could change your friends' thinking on that, too, and get them to think the way you're thinking now?
Yeah, I wish, but, like, my close boys, like, the ones that are true to my heart and everything, we close, like, we like brothers and all, mm-hmm. They pretty much change it. The only thing that we can't change in most of my boys is that they won't stop selling drugs. It's because none of us could get a job yet. And if we could get a job, that if they found out we had, like, a criminal record, a lot of people won't accept you and all that. Because that's, like, in the mall and all, they look into that or whatever. I don't know. I heard they look into that. So they'd be like, no, we can't have you here or whatever. So they just keep on selling drugs because it makes more money.
You said that, you know, at the detention center, at the prep program, you've learned things about not, you know, trying not to get into a fight every time somebody says something. Is there something that has changed in you that makes you more likely to listen to that and take that seriously? Or is this the first time anyone has even given you that advice?
Like, nah, this ain't the first time I got that voice. It's just that my attitude changed a lot as I got locked up. Like, I grew up from, like, the age of 3 to the age of 15, like, over the last 7 months, it seems like. Because before, you might as well say I was like a little kid before because I just did whatever thing to please myself. But now I got to do stuff not to please others, but to be proud of myself and also others, too. And to set an example for, like, my boys, I'm going to try to set an example for them. Even though I ain't older than most of them, but I got respect from a lot of them. I can set an example. And I also got little cousins and little sisters and stuff like that. My little sister and everybody, I want to try to set an example for, too.
What kind of job would you like to get, and what kind of job do you think you'll be able to get?
Well, I got 2 job offers when I get out of here now. Like, one's at a diner,
mm-hmm.
like a restaurant, and one's at a pizza parlor.
Mm-hmm.
And I got no problem with it because it's basically easy money too. All I gotta do is like wait on tables or something at both places and make food, so that's not that hard. I'm gonna have to like work harder than selling drugs and all, but it's pretty much easy. It's not what I want to do in my life, but for now it's good enough.
Are you thinking about what you do want to do with the rest of your life? Or, I mean, that's a really big question, and it's sometimes impossible to answer. Sometimes you never know till it happens.
Nah, I've been locked up for a while, so I've been thinking about it a lot.
Uh-huh. So what are you thinking?
Like, I know I want to get out of here and I'll go back to school. And, like, since while I'm in here, because I'm here because there's something that happened in school, so it's going to get harder to go back to a regular school. I'm going to have to go to, like, I don't know what you call it, like a reform school or something. Like for people that like get in trouble a lot or something.
Uh-huh.
But I want to go back to a regular school, high school and all. So I'm going to try to go back to that and get my diploma and graduate and everything, whatever. And then I want to just like, I don't know. I'm not sure if I want to go to college or not, because I was looking into being like a chef because I like cooking and stuff like that. So I might go to like a culinary arts school or something.
That's interesting. What kinds of dishes do you most like to cook?
Like, I don't know, like, I don't really cook anything now. I just cook easy stuff now, but I now cook, like, a lot of Italian foods and stuff.
Uh-huh. Like pastas and sauces?
Yeah, that's easy.
My guest, who will remain anonymous, spoke to us from the PrEP program run by the Camden County Probation Office. It's a residential education program. We'll hear from a teenager who used to sell drugs after this break. This is Fresh Air. We continue our discussion about young people and crime. My guest, Eric Penny, used to deal drugs. Like our first guest, he spent time at the Camden County Youth Center, a detention center in New Jersey. Now he's starting a new life, living with an aunt in rural New Jersey. Derek is 18 years old and Latino. He spent his early childhood in New York, but was later sent to Camden, New Jersey.
After my father died in New York, I moved to Camden with my grandmother. And after a year of living with her, she sort of got tired of us, so I moved in with my aunt. And my cousins were already selling drugs, so eventually I started too.
Now, your cousins were selling drugs and you were living with your aunt. Did your aunt know that they were selling
drugs?
Yes,
she did.
What was her attitude about it?
Well, she never really said anything about it. So
even though she knew?
Yeah, she just permitted it. She just let it happen.
Was there anyone to tell you that it was a bad idea to sell drugs?
No.
No one told you that?
I knew it was, but nobody told me.
So what kind of drugs were you selling?
I was selling marijuana first when I was about 15 years old. I started.
And then?
And then I moved on to selling marijuana, cocaine, and crack cocaine.
Did you make a lot of money?
Sort of. It was enough for me.
How much would you say you made in a week when you were doing well? Yeah. Or in a day, whichever is easier to come up with.
In a day, I would make about, you know, $90, $100.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's enough.
What would you spend it on?
Mm-hmm. I would go to the movies with friends or just hang out and buy clothes. That's it.
Did you ever use drugs yourself?
I smoked marijuana.
But you wouldn't do anything?
No.
Why not?
Because when I was really small and living in Brooklyn, New York, I saw what, you know, heavy drugs did to people. I saw people catch overdoses and, you know, just walking around the street and looking all trifling, and I didn't want to look like that or for anything to happen to me.
Had you tried to get, like, a straight job before you started selling drugs?
No. I was too young.
Because you were 15?
Yeah.
So you couldn't have gotten a job then?
Mm-hmm.
Did you need the money badly?
Yes. I was taking care of myself, so I needed the money.
Does that mean you had to buy your own food? Well, and what did you have to do for yourself that no one else would do that you needed money
for? I had to wash my clothes, and I wanted money, you know, for whenever I wanted to do something. Or somebody said, well, we're going out to the movies tonight, so I would want money. And if I wasn't selling drugs, I wouldn't have any money to do anything that I wanted to.
What was it like when you were arrested? What happened?
The first time, I was very scared. I didn't know what they were going to do to me. But
how did you get caught?
I was walking down the street, and the cops pulled up on me. And they all got out of the car and drew their guns and told us to put up our hands and stuff like that. And I got caught with marijuana in my pocket. So they took me down to the station. And then I stood there for a couple hours, and then they let me call a taxi and go home.
Really?
Yeah.
And what happened the second time?
The second time, I was in the Lakeland.
What's that?
The detention center.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, for about 4 days. And then I went to court, and they let me go home.
So that was, there's only been 2 times?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a third time, but third time I stood there for a month and 10 days.
At the detention center?
Yes.
What was your experience like at the detention center? Was it a good experience, a bad
experience?
Yes,
it was very good. I had a lot of time to think and, you know, look at what would happen if I continued to sell drugs or if I stopped and went back to school. And what I saw, if I continued to sell drugs, was nothing. I couldn't see nothing. And I thought about going back to school and everything, and I saw that I can get a good job, and I would get a lot more respect.
Do you have people in your life who you've known either for a long time or a short time,
yeah,
who you look up to, who are models for you?
Well, there was this one person that worked in a store,
mm-hmm,
and it was called Mike's Mini Market. He was the owner. His name was Mike. And the first and second time I got locked up, he had found out about it because he knew my family, you know. And every time I went into the store, he would, like, talk to me and tell me, you know, the things that should be done. And I knew what he was saying was true, but I just didn't want to listen to him. But it felt good. It felt real good to have somebody talk to me like that. But At first, I never really paid attention to him. But he kept on and kept on talking to me every time he saw me. And his wife did, too. So finally, every time, you know, when I was still selling drugs, I thought about, you know, everything he had said to me before. And it made a lot of sense. So it did a lot for me to have somebody talk to me like that.
Are you still in touch with him now?
Well, I see him every time I go to Camden.
Did you have people in your family who said that kind of stuff for you?
No.
What about your mother in New York? Are you in touch with her much?
I talked to her once in a while, but she never even spoke to me like that.
Do you wish your mother did?
Yeah.
Does she use drugs herself?
She used to. She's in rehabilitation now.
Did she use drugs when you were living with her?
Yes.
What was it like to know that your mother was using?
It hurt a lot, but I was really young when she started, so I didn't understand it that much. And it went on for years, and I never really understood it because I was real small. But as I got older, I learned about what drugs were and what they did to people. And I saw the symptoms in my mom, so I knew she was doing drugs.
Well, that's how you found out?
Yeah.
Are you angry with her for all that?
I'm not angry. I'm angry that she made that choice to do the drugs, but I'm not angry at her.
So what kind of living situation do you have now?
Now, I'm living with my aunt, and she does a lot for me. She washes my clothes, and she's like sort of my second mom. And I go to school from near, and she does a lot for me.
Can I ask you about some of your best and worst childhood memories?
I start off with the worst.
Okay.
One Halloween, well, it was Mischief Night. We had all got dressed up in black and had went out to cause mischief. And we were in Kramer Hill in Camden, and someone in the car had stopped and fired a gun twice. And everybody had scattered. There was a whole bunch of us, about 90 or 100 of us. And everybody just scattered. And I was with my cousins. I didn't know anybody else but my cousin. So everybody ran. And I thought I had saw my cousin duck into an alley. So I followed. And I bumped into one of the guys that were in the car. And he had a knife. Another guy had a gun. And they made me strip, you know, to see if I had anything they wanted. So, and I didn't, so they just let me go. I had told them that I lived in the house, and I had just came out to see why everybody was running in my yard.
That was something good to come up with.
Yeah.
That sounds terrifying.
I was scared.
So what are some of the good memories?
Good. I can't remember, because they were like when my father was alive. So I can't remember too well.
And when was that? How long ago did he die?
When I was about 4 years old.
What did he die of?
He was murdered.
He was murdered?
Yeah.
Do you know the circumstances of the murder?
He was shot by the landlord. I think it was a money problem or something.
By the landlord?
Yeah.
Do you know a lot of people who've been shot?
Yeah.
Friends, family?
Friends, my cousin.
Is this one of the cousins he was dealing, who you
yeah.
lived with?
Yeah.
So you back in high school now?
No, I'm in a GED program.
So you're studying at home?
Yeah, I go to night school, and I study at home. I do some studying at home.
Is there a subject you're most interested in that you're studying?
Yeah, math is the hardest subject, so.
Is there a kind of work you'd like to have, a kind of job you'd like to have when you're done?
Well, I like a chance at helping people. No, I don't care how.
People kind of like the guy at Mike's Mini Market helped
yeah,
you?
Yeah, in my situation, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like it would be really interesting work to do.
Yeah, it would.
You've talked about how at the detention center, when you were there for a few months, you had time to think. When you had time to think, it really changed your life.
Yeah.
Did you not have time to think before?
What do you mean?
Was it hard to find time to just think?
While I was out on the streets?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the way I see it, you're always, you know, trying to make somebody believe that you're okay, you know, you're not like a nerd or something. I don't know. It's just, you never want to think.
Why don't you want to think?
You don't want to think positive, because positive things, you know, most people are doing negative things, so you're just going to follow with them.
Derek Penny will be back with us in the second part of our show to talk about his new life. He's living with an aunt in the country. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, creating a safe place for kids who've never had one. We talk with Mary Previty about the Camden County Youth Center, a detention center where, ironically, many kids find comfort and structure for the first time. Previty is the center's administrator. We'll talk with her about how she tries to steer kids away from trouble and about her own childhood in a Japanese internment camp. And we'll hear more from one of the teenagers who spent time at the center, Derek Penny. That's coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Abortion rights advocates asked the Supreme Court today to protect abortion clinics and their clients from protesters who use terrorist tactics. The National Organization for Women and the Clinton administration argued the justices should allow lower courts to apply federal anti-racketeering laws to anti-abortion groups who use violence. Outside the court, anti-abortion activist Amy Tracy said the so-called RICO law should apply to any protesters who organize violent acts to press their cause.
I think this law would apply to anyone that uses violence and terror, force, threats of force, to intimidate anyone out of their rights, whether it's a nuclear protester, an anti-abortion protester, or a pro-choice protester. We happen to be the National Organization for Women, and we stick up for the rights of women and the rights of women to be free, and also the right to an abortion, which is a constitutional right.
But an attorney for Operation Rescue and several other anti-abortion groups says the RICO law, devised to apply to organized crime, was never meant to cover demonstrations on social issues. During oral arguments, the justices gave no indication of how they will rule. If the court rules that the RICO law applies, Jack Ames of the organization Defend Life says anti-abortion groups will have to develop new tactics.
I think it'll mean that we'll have to do utilize many other methods, many of which we're already utilizing, to use our power of moral persuasion to convince others, including abortionists, that abortion is wrong, and whether it's legal or not, that they shouldn't do it.
The court is due to rule before July. Xerox Corporation says it will eliminate 10% of its worldwide workforce. Lisa Barr of member station WEDW reports from Stamford, Connecticut.
10,000 people in positions ranging from clerical to managerial will lose their jobs, half in 1994. The other 5,000 face the street within 2 to 3 years. A Xerox spokesman says employee committees have not yet decided how many or which plants to close or consolidate. Xerox CEO Paul Allaire says this restructuring intensifies an ongoing focus on productivity. Today's announcement follows a reported settlement by Xerox of a class-action antitrust lawsuit. The Dow Jones News Service reported yesterday that customers and independent service organizations accused Xerox of suppressing competition in high-volume photocopiers. Xerox officials refused to comment on the settlement, which is subject to court approval. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Barr in Stamford.
On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 16 points to close at another record high, 3734.53. Advances edged declines in heavy trading of 312 million shares. This is NPR News. The Long Island Police Commissioner says the rush hour shooting rampage that killed 4 passengers on the Long Island Railroad was racially motivated. Commissioner Donald Kane says the black suspect has told police he hates whites, Asians, and conservative blacks. He's been identified as Colin Ferguson of Brooklyn. Kane adds that the suspect says he carried out the attack on Long Island to avoid embarrassing New York City's outgoing black mayor, David Dinkins. Authorities say the gunman probably boarded in New York City, and passengers say 18 miles outside the city, the gunman opened fire on the packed train. One witness describes the gunman's face as emotionless. He was tackled by 3 passengers when he ran out of bullets for a third time. 2 right-wing extremists in Germany have been convicted of murder for the deaths of 3 Turks in an arson attack last year. NPR's Deidre Berger reports.
Michael Peters and Lars Christensen were convicted on charges of murder, attempted murder, and arson.
The 26-year-old Peters, a local ringleader of right-wing activities, was sentenced to life in prison. 20-year-old Lars Christensen, who was tried as a juvenile, received a 10-year sentence. The firebombing of the house belonging to a Turkish family in the city of Mulm aroused international outrage and strained German-Turkish relations. Peters and Christensen initially admitted the crime, but later recanted, claiming they were put under pressure by justice authorities. There was criticism in the German press that prosecutors did not follow up on other leads, such as ties to the underworld. The prosecutor based his case on testimony from an 8-year-old girl who lived across the street from the house that was attacked. I'm Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
A Chinese businessman used a surgeon's knife to commandeer a passenger plane today. He forced the pilot to divert the domestic flight to Taiwan. It was the eighth time since April a plane has been hijacked from China to Taiwan. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. You may think of a youth detention center as a place to punish young people charged with crimes. Mary Previty sees it as a place to save their lives. Since 1974, Previty has been the administrator of the Camden County Youth Center in New Jersey. Young people are sent there after they are arrested and held while they await trial. The average stay is a couple of weeks, but some remain for several months. About 850 young people pass through the center each year. Previty says they come from varied racial backgrounds and from every economic group, but the majority are the children of the poor. I asked her if she's found certain patterns in the problems that these young people have faced.
Families falling apart is probably the most important theme. If a boy or girl doesn't have a father and mother rooting for them, supporting them, advising them, telling them when to come in, setting patterns for them, expectations, hopes, making a dream of the future in their head, that boy or girl is going to soak up the messages from the street. And more than anything else, the crumbling family is the theme that we see among boys and girls that come to the youth center.
What else?
Another is the need for money, the fascination with glitzy clothes, owning records or cars or dirt bikes, the whole materialism that you've got to be surrounded and having this in order to be somebody. You're not really anybody at all unless you're surrounded with all these. I mean, it has to be the name brand. It can't just be nice, clean jeans. And some of the boys even tell me it isn't just the name brands. It's got to be pressed at the dry cleaner so somebody knew that you were able to afford to get this done at the dry cleaner. It's the whole outside show is who you are, not who you are on the inside.
Have a lot of the young people who you've seen been abused by their parents? Is that a contributing factor too, do you think?
Very, very common. I would say there are times in the girls' population, we may have 90 to 100% of the girls have been physically and sometimes sexually abused. And we feel that it's a common theme with some of the boys, but boys are not as quick to talk about being victims of sexual abuse as girls are. But abuse is a very, very common theme. Troubles with school. Most of our children are way behind in school performance of what you would expect a boy or girl that age. And we will get boys 10 years old, do not know the letters of the alphabet, but they can tell you how to train a killer dog. And this theme of violence is a thread that it just comes through all portions of their life. I think one of the things that really astonished me, we began to see boys and girls just blossoming in our classroom. And you'd say, why is this? We've had people walk down the halls and say, well, these school rooms here would be the envy of any schoolroom in America. You wouldn't walk in any public or private school as orderly as this. And I began to wonder how that could be with children in a juvenile detention center, all of a sudden, taking seriously their school. Well, I have to give a lot of credit to the teachers. But then I began to dawn on me. We took terror out of their lives. We discovered that when boys and girls come in, one of the first messages the officers will say is, we will not let you hurt somebody while you're here, and we will not let anyone hurt you. So there was a sense that you're going to be safe in this place.
What's your philosophy at the detention center? about how to help the young people who are there in the short time that you have to spend with them?
Well, first of all, there's only one set of rules, Mary Previty's rules. The boys and girls come from a squishy world with no rules, no structure. Do whatever you want. If there have been no parents around, they come and go in their homes as they please, when they please. I had one boy say to me, and he was a 13-year-old charged with murder. He said, "A mom's supposed to say, don't do that." And he was horrified when he says, "You climb out the window or you go away, and she ain't even ask you when you come in." A world of no rules. And here is a kid saying, "But she's supposed to ask me," begging for structure. So I say, we will make a world that is comfortingly predictable. There's nothing squishy about the floor. You put your foot down here. You will do it this way and only this way. It's not going to be unpredictable. It's not going to be uncomfortable. You will know every day when someone's going to wake you up. You will know every day when it's time to clean up. You will know when you're going to go to school. You will know when you're going to eat. You will know when you're going to go to bed. And there's a certain way that you talk to people. And there's a certain way that you will talk, that you will respond to people. So the predictable structure. Our children are living in an unpredictable world that is so frightening because they don't know when they put their foot down on any day, whether it's going to be solid or when it's going to be squishy. No child can feel safe in a world like that.
No, I've been reading a little bit about the center, and I read that one of the things that you do, there are clean and tidy competitions.
In which
people compete for how clean they keep their part.
My assistant complained to me early on that they were pretty piggy and beds weren't made, and we decided in competition, and so we decided that that we would do a daily clean and tidy inspection, and I said, I'll be the one. That makes a good excuse for an administrator to be real close to the kids and in the midst of everything, and I rather like that. So the first day we introduced the clean and tidy, they said, well, you know, you have to have instant reward. So they'll never know you've been around unless you leave something on their windows. So I left a little M&M sticker or 3M sticker with a little message like good or marvelous or happy or proud or something like that, or fat, whatever their current language was. The second day, well, that was to show that their bedroom was wonderful and clean. And the next day, the social worker in the younger boys' unit came to me, and Leo said, well, my boys want to know where their stickers are. I said, well, Leo, I'm not going to put a sticker on everybody's door every day. He says, my boys want to know where their stickers are. They have been getting stickers on their door from that day to the present time, and some of them will wallpaper their bedroom door with stickers with all the words that I write on them and a happy face every day. We do enormous amounts of saying, we notice how good you're being, and we appreciate it.
My guest is Mary Previty, administrator of the Camden County Youth Center in New Jersey. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Previty, administrator of the Camden County Youth Center. There was an article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was just about a year ago. And it was an article about teenage violence. And after interviewing many people, the authors of this article reached the conclusion that teenagers feel little remorse or regret for their crimes. And they often think the victims were just asking for it. How does that mesh with what you've seen?
I think it's true. I think it often is true. A human being who from the earliest age has been violated by being beaten or shouted at or not cared for, a four-year-old that has to be responsible for taking care of himself and any other brothers or sisters, that type of thing. There's a survival thing called distancing. And all of those terrors of being alone, there is no greater terror for a child than having no one to take care of you. None. That is the ultimate terror. The terror hides and runs into the cracks and crannies of a child's soul and is cut off. They hide behind all kinds of things, so all of a sudden, the feelings stop. And you see that, you hear it when you listen to a boy or girl talking to you. You hear about a kid that's been abandoned or has had this horrible thing, and I'm listening, I'm saying, I'm waiting to hear the tears. I'm waiting to hear the anger. I'm waiting to hear the voice go up or the voice go to a whisper. And I hear this flat, monotone talking about horrors. I get it every day when we do the student newspaper. Being stuck up, robbed at gunpoint, going to the funeral and seeing their friends buried. And a flat monotone like it was no big deal. And I keep saying, please let the tears come out. Please shout. Let me know that you care. And I suddenly realize it's like the post-traumatic stress syndrome. The feelings disappeared someplace long ago. I don't know where they're hidden. But when you squeeze out the terror and you hide and the anger and the rage, it will come out in other horrible ways, and it comes out in just what you described. No big deal. I wasted him. No big deal. It's a survival mechanism, and it isn't going to go away, because as long as we continue not nurturing children, not caring for them, not making them feel safe, not helping them to see the future, they have no investment in you or me or the neighborhood or the schools.
I want to ask you about something in your background that I have a feeling has some connection to the work you're doing now and the philosophy that you take. You grew up in China, where your parents were Methodist missionaries, and I believe it was at the beginning of World War II, you and all the students and teachers from your school were taken prisoners in a Japanese concentration camp after Japan invaded China. Did you have experiences in this concentration camp that helped you do the work that you're doing now in some way or understand how you should be doing it?
Well, I didn't think of that until much later, but I think a lot of what I do at the youth center is very similar to what our teachers that were marched off to prison camp with us. We had these marvelous Victorian schoolmarm missionary teachers in our school that were marched off with us. We didn't see our parents for 5.5 years, so you've got a whole school of children with no parents. And they seemed to know instinctively what to do with kids in a prison camp. It was the most astonishing thing.
Well, who did, the teachers?
The teachers did. The teachers did. And here were guard dogs and electrified wires and bayonet practice and all this, all the other horrors of war that no child should ever know. And these teachers would say, they didn't say it this way, but it was, they made a very predictable atmosphere. We knew when we'd get up in the morning. Does that sound like what I said to you a bit ago?
Exactly.
We knew when we would get up in the morning, we'd hear Miss Stark come in to nudge us all to get up. We knew when we had to scrub our little portion of floor that was around our steamer trunks. We slept on steamer trunks. There were no beds. We knew when we were going to march off to eat. And the teachers insisted that we were going to continue with school, even though it meant sitting on the floor or sitting on the steamer trunks and using slates and a piece of chalk to do our schoolwork. And there was a very comfortingly predictable structure. And, of course, absolutely God was going to take care of us. There was no question about that. So that was a very comforting thing. They surrounded us with a world that we knew what to expect, despite Japanese guard dogs and Japanese bayonet practice around us. And I think I do much of the same thing at the youth center.
What kind of expectations of your behavior did the teachers have while you were in the concentration camp?
Well, our teachers, we were growing up in the time of Princess Elizabeth and Princess Margaret Rose, who were the princes of Buckingham Palace. I was born British, so these were great characters in our life. And our teacher said, you will sit up straight with your backs up straight at the dining hall where you might be eating slop out of a tin can. And they said, there is not one set of rules for Buckingham Palace or outside world and another set of rules for the Weixian concentration camp. So we had to have rules and manners just like Princess Margaret Rose and Princess Elizabeth, even in the confines of a Japanese prison camp.
You have really just a few weeks with most of the teenagers who come in. And you do what you can in that time to instill a sense of confidence, of positive thinking. But then they're going to be out, and if they're not sent to reform school or something, they're going to be back in the neighborhood where they got into trouble in the first place. What are the pressures on a young person when they go back home afterwards?
They're horrible pressures. They will be back in the same neighborhood, inside the same house. They'll be surrounded by their same friends. And I will tell you, most kids say it is almost impossible to break free from the patterns that they've developed with their friends, particularly if they don't have a supportive parent. If they don't have a dad or a mom that's setting the rules and really reining them in. So the neighborhoods just devour children. They'll say, you cannot stay in your four walls forever. Once you go out, you're down with the boys. And that pretty much is the truth. Many of the kids will say that school has no meaning for them, that there is really nothing positive to influence them. And I think that's the profound message that comes that we need to get out to people. We have got to say, I am Mr. Mike in a grocery store, and I can be the only person that is going to touch this boy that comes in, and I will do it. Or I will take this girl who lives in my neighborhood that I see, and I will bring her into my home and listen to her. Listening is one of the most important things. We have got to feel that we can make a difference in our world, and it happens by small, tiny, tiny pieces, one child at a time.
Mary Previty is the administrator of the Camden County Youth Center in New Jersey. In a minute, we'll hear more from Derek Penny, who, after spending time there, is trying to start a new life. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing President Clinton's remarks about crime in reaction to the shootings on the Long Island Railroad. Also, the water crisis in and around Washington, D.C. Linda Gradstein reports on the sixth anniversary of the Palestinian Intifada, what the effects of the uprising have been on a Palestinian family and also on an Israeli family. And we'll be hearing about the funeral of Yetta Adams, a woman who died in Washington, D.C. at a bus shelter across the street from the Department of Housing and Urban Development last week. Those stories coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Earlier, we heard from 18-year-old Derek Penny, who was held at the Camden County Youth Center after he was arrested for dealing drugs. The administrator of the center, Mary Previty, told us that it's very difficult for young people to stay out of trouble when they return to their neighborhoods. That's why Derek Penny wanted to change his environment. He's now living with an aunt in rural New Jersey.
There's not, like, a lot of people walking around. There's never anybody walking around. And you just don't see what you see in the city. So it's just different.
Is it less violent, less people with guns, less people dealing drugs?
There's nobody.
Is it a relief to be away from that?
Yeah. It's relaxing.
Now, how did you get to go there?
I asked my lawyer to talk to the judge about me leaving Camden. And I guess he liked the idea, so.
So you wanted to get out of Camden?
Yeah.
Why did you want to get out?
Because, like I said, I had time to think, and that was one of the things that would help me do what I wanted to do.
To get away from the streets?
Yeah.
Did you feel the need to get away from the people you knew also?
No. They never had, like, they never influenced me to do anything I didn't want to do.
So you sound very independent.
Yeah. I just did what I wanted to do, what I felt was okay.
So living where you are now, do people know that you were in the detention center, and does that affect your reputation in their eyes? Are they suspicious of you because of that?
Well, not everybody knows because I don't know many people where I live. Mm-hmm. So, and they don't get that deep into my life anyway. So,
does the aunt you're living with now work?
Yeah.
What kind of work does she do?
She works on an egg farm.
Had you ever been to a farm before or been to the country before?
No, never.
What do you think of it? Do you like it?
Yeah, it's something I never done before, so it's a good experience.
Do you think you'd want to stay in the country for a while? Do you do any farm work yourself?
No.
Do you have any animals? Or?
No, we just have cats, that's all.
Right. Are you still in touch with your mother?
Yeah, I call her every once in a while.
And she's in rehab now?
Yeah.
Are you hopeful about that, do you think?
Yeah, I hope it makes a change.
Yeah. You do seem very independent, and I know, particularly, you know, with teenagers, you really usually care about what everybody else thinks of you, and you try to fit in, and in different neighborhoods that means different things. You seem to really not care about that. Were you always that way? Was there somebody who helped you be that way?
No, I just grew up that way. I don't know what it was. I just did.
Seems like a good thing. Do you think of it as a good thing?
Yeah. I never really liked to depend on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I like to do everything for myself. Because the fact is my mother never really, you know, attended to me like she was supposed to. And my father died when I was real young. So I just took it upon myself to do everything for myself.
If you could say something to parents that would help them understand their kids, what would you say?
It just takes time. You have to talk. It may not happen, you know, when you want it to, but I don't know. You just can't give up at all. You have to keep at it.
Well, I wish you good luck.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
It's okay.
18-year-old Derek Penny. Earlier we heard from Mary Previty, director of the Camden County Youth Center in New Jersey. Our program today was produced by Dorothy Farabee, Naomi Person, Joan Tui, and Roberta Shurrock with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Devin Reif and Abby Fanta are our interns. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.